CBS News Brief. Strong winds have been fueling a California wildfire that has prompted evacuations near Gorman in northwestern Los Angeles County. Fire Department Captain Sheila Kelleher-Burko.
When the wind is lying down, they really use it to their advantage and hit certain hot sides of the fire. So super strategic. We've got a ton of agencies out here and a lot of people working on this fire.
More than 80% of the country is facing scorching temperatures this week from Arizona to Maine. More from CBS News Chicago's Tara Molina.
This is being called the most significant heat event of the year, which makes sense. We're into June now, and there are nearly 200 high temperature records that are set to be broken across the United States.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has disbanded his country's war cabinet. BBC reporter John Donison in Jerusalem.
There will be more decision-making in the hands of Netanyahu and a small group of ministers and allies, but increasingly he looks very much an isolated figure politically.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Saff. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Ann Jacobs, newly elected chair of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, has voiced her support for criticized elections administrator Megan Wolf. As Wisconsin's top election official, Wolf had been the target of criticism since the 2020 presidential election. Supporters of Donald Trump accused Wolf of election fraud, and Wisconsin Republicans failed to impeach her earlier this year. Jacobs spoke to WISN-TV's Upfront.
Megan Wolf has done an outstanding job, and the idea that we would not have her be our administrator because people believe in conspiracy theories is not how you run good government.
Both Jacobs and Wolf will oversee the presidential election in Wisconsin in November. A heat wave has rolled into Wisconsin. Temperatures are expected to be in the low 90s in some parts of the state Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, with heat indexes in the high 90s. Thunderstorms are also expected this week. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
The Morning Show on WFHR. It's serious comedy.
Some researchers have explored the impact of melatonin-enriched milk on sleep because it comes from cows milked at night.
Ooh.
Night milk has been shown to improve symptoms of insomnia in some people.
Night milk. Yeah. We should try some night milk.
Night milk. Yeah.
I would love to actually talk to somebody who actually does this. If this is like a new avenue for milk growers.
How about
milk
that?
Producers, I should say.
Yep.
Milk doesn't grow on trees. I learned that when I was 20.
Weekdays from 8 to 10 on Locally Grown Radio.
You're listening to Locally Grown Radio, WFHR, home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Hope everyone had a wonderful, safe, healthy, happy, family-uniting Father's Day weekend. For me, you know, this is one of those holidays never really knew existed until I became a father myself. But it's a weekend, and it's a day where I think about, one, the promises that I made to my children, and how I be a better father. And it's also a time where I think about my politics. I think about how I got where I'm at. I think about the positions that I've taken on a lot of social programs, a lot of social policies. And it goes back to the fact that, you know, my mother was a teenage mother. My father was a deadbeat. I don't know his name. Never met him, never seen him. I don't think he's ever seen me. And have never had any contact with him whatsoever. Don't know his name, don't want to know his name. And this is one of those moments where you go, on this kind of a day, my mind goes into being grateful for the social programs that were there that helped my mother, who at the time, just a child herself, of 16, that then 17 years old, helped us survive. We didn't live high off the hog. We didn't, you know, the welfare was not the great living. The projects that I grew up in were definitely not a great place. But it was a roof over the head. There was food on the table most of the time. We were somewhat secure, safe. And And I think about those programs and the people who want to destroy those programs. And I'm grateful for them because it gave me the opportunity to survive. Now, over my working career, trust me, I have paid back in handsome sums all of the investment our government made in me. But it's almost like our government is it's almost part of, it's almost like a father figure in that it helped provide for the things, the basic, simple staples that children need to thrive and survive. Food, a roof over your head, and education, opportunity. And I think about the kid growing up in the place that I grew up in and wonder if that child's going to have the same kind of opportunities to prosper and to succeed and live a life that is worth living. And I think about this because I say this all the time. I have lived a life that as a child growing up could have never imagined. I've done things that as a child growing up in the projects could have never fathomed. And now, is that because I didn't have the basis of parents who wanted great things? Possibly. But it's also the fact that I've been very fortunate and very lucky in a lot of times. And all of us on a day like Father's Day, I think about that good fortune. You know, any of us could have been born like I was into a poverty situation, or worse. Look, I've said people had it much worse than I did. But I was able to find a path that made me somewhat successful. I grew up in a place where there was poverty and danger and basically man's inhumanity to man. And now I live in a good, solidly upper middle class neighborhood with doctors and lawyers and the such. Because I worked hard, played by the rules and was able to move forward, but also because of my union. The reality is the work that I've done over the years has been compensated at a level that gave me opportunities to do things like this, to start this little program, to help grow this little program, and to reach people and say, look, this is what I think is important. And the policies that I think are really important are those basic social safety net programs that says nobody falls below this line. We don't let people in the wealthiest country in the history of humanity, we don't let them fall through the cracks. There are policies I would like to see us move on, which would be much, much greater. For instance, I've said a million times, I'm not a huge fan of welfare programs, of handout programs. I'm a huge fan of jobs guarantees. If the private sector can't or won't, more likely, create enough jobs for working people to have the dignity and respect of a reasonable paying job, then the public sector has to do that. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done. We could, if we had the will, if we had the political wherewithal. Instead, we're fed all kinds of nonsense to tear us apart. And even on a day like Father's Day, there's somebody out there thinking, how can we divide people? Where for me, this is an opportunity to go, look, we should be caring for each other. Because no matter where you are in this moment, things can change. I mean, we saw during the pandemic, people for the first time having to navigate social safety net programs, they never thought they were going to have to. And not knowing how to go about it because we've made them so difficult. We means test and we put hoops and drug tests and all kinds of invasive stuff in the way just to help feed people. It's crazy. And look, imagine, someone getting a cancer diagnosis or a long-term illness where they can't work. And now you need to go through the Social Security system, the food stamp programs, the LIHEAP, all of these hodgepodge of Band-Aids that are supposed to be there to help people when they need it. But we've so muddied the waters because someone who doesn't need it might get it. So for me on Father's Day, I think about that stuff. Now, I've been very fortunate. My wife and I had this conversation the other night as we were returning from a concert. I have been fortunate that when we had our three children,
I made a promise to myself that they were never going to go hungry. That there would never not be food in the house for them to eat. I was never going to look them in the eye and know they were hungry, and there was nothing I could do about it. They were never going to have to worry about where they laid their head. They were never going to be without the basic things that they need to be functional in a school setting. And I was going to show them as much affection as I can. And I can say I did all those things. And I want all parents to be able to do that, to have the ability, the resources, to be able to do the things that parents need to do. Because now more than ever, kids need two parents. They need people who are gonna be there. I think of what my life would have been like had there been a second parent. We probably wouldn't have lived in the kind of poverty we did. Potentially could have had, you know, different avenues, but you know, I probably wouldn't be the person I am today. So who knows? But on this Father's Day, my mind goes to, I want to thank the policymakers of the past who made it possible for me to be able to go, you know what? I worked hard. I played by the rules and I've done okay. So I hope everyone had a good holiday. Had a good, memorable Father's Day. Hope you had the opportunity to meet with Dad and if he's still around and do the things that that families do on these holidays. I want to hear your thoughts. Any stories about Dad? Anything good? Anything that you want to pass along? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, I hate the corporate media. And I think I've said this before, I hate corporate media a lot because of the nonsense that they spew, because of the BS that they keep trying to shovel our way. CNN Business, I caught a headline day before yesterday. Amazon is slashing prices on 4,000 grocery items. They will be joining Target and Walmart. So I read this headline. I'm going, oh my gosh, Amazon slashing prices on 4,000 grocery items. I'm like, did I know Amazon was a grocery store? Did I know people get their groceries from there? No, I actually didn't. But they're slashing items. And my mind goes, well, wait a second. You know, they could have kept the prices low from the beginning. They didn't have to raise them because their profit margins haven't really gone down. In fact, their profits, wow, have grown enormously over the last couple of years. You think about the year before the pandemic, you know, 2019, their profit was, what, $114 billion, almost $115 billion? That's profit. That's not operating expenses. It's profit. 2020, the year of the pandemic, almost $153 billion. 2021, pushing $198 billion. 2022, almost $226 billion. And you know, 2023, over $270 billion. In fact, first quarter of 2024, you know, $10 billion just in that that year, that quarter profit. And you go, that's a lot of money. And look, I'm tired of hearing about, you know, corporations are doing the right thing. No, they've been lining their pockets for a while. Their profits have gone through the ceiling. And yet we've got our mainstream corporate-controlled media going, oh, look, how wonderful. Amazon slashing prices on 4,000 items. What about the other 50,000? Oh, that no, bridge too far. And I saw this video of Warren Buffett, who said that his company paid $5 billion in taxes last year. And he made the simple statement. He goes, look, if the top 800 companies in the country did that, if, you know, the profitable companies, you know, your big ones on Wall Street, if they did that, you and me and working people wouldn't have to pay payroll taxes. You wouldn't have to pay taxes. There's enough money there to operate most of our government. And, you know, he goes into this thing about how, you know, they did a survey in the office, found out that the secretary was paying a rate higher than he was. And you go, when the secretary is paying a higher tax rate than the CEO, problem. And maybe something that would be, I don't know, something that working people would go, this is wrong. But here's the weird thing. This is societal grooming. This is that constant indoctrination. And it's incredibly powerful. The narrative that we've been sold about, you know, corporate, you know, power and the need to, you know, to give the smart people all the money because we need a tax code that is going to benefit, you know, trickle down. And you go, but hold on, wait a second. Help me here because I'm struggling. They're the ones with all the money. Because we've given it to them. We've created a billionaire class larger than any, I would argue, probably in history. And we've given them such outweighed power in our country to be able to do, I think, virtually anything they want. We have a terrorist organization in this country, in my view, called the Business Roundtable, who could crash our economy if they so wanted. And I would argue we're living under some of that policy now because they've chosen to raise prices because they can, because it's good for their bottom line, and it's good for their pockets. We see this massive CEO pay. We see all of these corporate stock buybacks. We see all of this extracting wealth from working people and consumers and putting it into the pockets of the wealth class, the shareholder class, the ownership class. And I look at this pay package that Elon Musk got. Evidently, back in 2018, you had the shareholders there at Tesla going, yeah, our CEO is worth, you know, gazillions of dollars. And a court said, no, I don't think so. That's crazy. It's a bit crazy. And now you've got the shareholders who voted 72% of them. 72% voted to give him what amounts to about a $47 billion windfall. Now, the price of the shares will fluctuate. They'll go up and down. But you're talking about $47 billion. And I know, I've seen Moneyball. I've seen the Brad Pitt movie Moneyball. It's not about the money. It's what the money says. I get that. I understand. But this is saying that we're going to give one guy an enormous amount of power that we haven't done in this country in decades, probably since John D. Rockefeller. And there isn't a big enough push to stop this. For me, the fact that the wealth class, this incestuous pool of wealth, said, yeah, we're going to take from those workers, we're going to raise prices on consumers, we're going to do all of these things so that we can ensure that Elon's wealth cared for, of course ourselves too, is quite remarkable. And it's one of these things where you go, for me anyway, this is why we need to dig up Dwight D. Eisenhower. We need to go back to the good socialist President Ike's tax policies. So that, look, you can give Elon Musk $100 gazillion a year. Give up whatever you want. but we're going to tax it at 92%. And we're going to use that money for the betterment of society and not for the betterment of one person. You know, for me, that sounds like a reasonable thing to do. Maybe we make education more affordable. Maybe we make healthcare more affordable. Maybe we start spending more money on, I don't know, infrastructure, you know, you name it. Maybe pay our debt instead of running up massive amounts of debt so that we can enrich the wildly wealthy. Because, you know, you go back to Amazon, you know, because they're lowering their prices. Maybe they pay some of their taxes, because on the enormous amount of profit that they make, they pay an effective tax rate. What did I see? Somewhere between 1% and 9%. Because, now again, I'm not saying they did anything illegal. I'm saying that they've got an enormous amount of wealth that they can lobby to get the loopholes and the gimmicks and the things that they want so that they don't have to pay so much. So that they get more. And it goes back to what I've always said about government. And it's not me who said it. My high school government teacher back in eighth grade. You know, government decides who gets what. And what we're deciding right now is working people, you're not getting anything that you need. And this is where the anger should be focused in the right direction. The focus should be at these CEOs who are lining their pockets. The ones who have sold us on this idea of trickle-down economics. But are we surprised that the shareholders went and gave Elon this huge handout? No, we're not surprised at that. Shouldn't be shocked at all. But it got me thinking about, you know, the indoctrination of the American worker and this idea of trickle-down, this idea that if we can't tax the wealthy. Because, you know, they know they're smart. They know what to do with the money. They're gonna create jobs. They're gonna invest in the economy. They're gonna do all this wonderful stuff, and it'll trickle down on us, you know, like manna from heaven, like rivers of gold and honey, and you know, this idea that if we tax rich people, they won't be able to invest. They won't create opportunities for you to get that moderately minimum wage job. Or my other one that's one of my favorites. You know, we're simply just incentivizing success. You know, by giving them more opportunity to hoard more wealth, you know, they're going to work hard, which is nonsense. Because understand, you go back to the fabulous 50s, where you had a 92% top marginal tax rate, where everyone was paying higher taxes and we were redistributing it in a way that did invest in the country and pay for our wars, of course, the economy grew much faster. The economy was much more widely shared. And now we've been sold this Reaganomics, this supply-side voodoo Reaganomics for what? We're almost pushing 50 years, 45 years now. And the thing is, you know, we keep hearing these fear moments. You know, if you tax the rich, they're just going to shut down and they're going to move. They're going to close all the businesses and they're going to move. They're going to take their money and they're going to leave because they've got the money. And some may go. And you go, good luck. You know, let me know how it works out in another country. But if you come back, we're going to tax you with penalties too. But this idea that, you know, if we tax rich people, it's the same thing with the minimum wage. If you raise the minimum wage, you're going to lose jobs. Not true. But, you know, you stop and think about some of the other arguments. Well, it's not fair to tax people. It is, actually. Most societies throughout history, the stronger do more work. You know, go back to the caveman days. The one who could carry the most water back to the cave did. It was that simple. You didn't have the scrawny guy carrying all the water and the big burly guy carrying a thimble. It's not how it worked. But, you know, it doesn't end. I mean, the rationales for continuing to give rich people more and more and more, and that they're somehow smarter and they know how to use it better, or my one of my favorites is, you know, they're philanthropic. You know, wealthy people, they fund charities. And I'm like, how about we don't need charities? How about your labor pays for what you need? How about we have a government that creates enough jobs for people so that they don't need handouts, that they can have the dignity and self-respect that comes with work, that they can do things for themselves? How about that? But again, we keep hearing all these, you know, government's inefficient, private interests are so much more efficient. Nonsense. But these are the things that we've been sold. You're gonna shut down global innovation. No more competition. If you tax rich people, it's all bad. And the reality is, if you tax rich people, you get to use the money in ways that benefit society. And it's something we better start coming around to. Because as a society, we got to think about the we instead of just the me. Now, what I would like us to see us do, give Elon his $47 billion in stocks. But, you know, I think we should be adding a massive, financial transaction tax on stocks that are high frequency traded. Yeah, you want to go trading those stocks off? You want to, just to make pennies? We're going to tax you on it. Bring in some money. We close the carried interest loophole so that executives, especially big financial executives who are avoiding paying billions of dollars in taxes, we go after that. We tax CEOs like Elon Musk, who his compensation is, many multiples of what the frontline workers is. And we change what is considered compensation. We don't just go, he didn't realize the share price. He didn't sell it off. So you can't tax something you didn't realize. Nonsense. You absolutely can and should, because they never sell them. That's how they stay wealthy. They borrow money against it. They write off the interest on the loans. And you end up paying for that too. The game has been rigged. And this is where my Tea Party friends were right. Working people are taxed enough already. We need to be taxing these people. So when you have a CEO who's making 1,000 times what the person on the factory floors make, or 5,000 or 10,000 times, you know what? It's time we raise that up. And understand, and I've said this before, I am a tax and spend liberal. I believe we tax the very wealthy, big corporations, and we use that money in a way to better society, to do the things collectively we can't do individually. Pave roads, build schools, build hospitals, defend the country, do all of those things and do them well. Make sure they're well funded, make sure that they're well taken care of. Everything else we leave to the individual. It's not hard to think about. What I am not is a borrow, and then complain conservative. Borrow a boatload of money, give it to the very wealthy in the hopes that maybe the pie gets higher or whatever. And oddly enough, we just keep adding to the debt. I'm not one of those. So I think we do need to be raising taxes on the very wealthy. And another great place to start would be, I know President Biden has done some of this, a very small tax on stock buybacks. I think it's 1%. I'm like, you open the door. Good. How about we just kick it off the hinges? How about we treat that like we would treat, the secretary that's working at Warren Buffett's company. Maybe we start charging the tax rates on all income for rich people the same rate that it is for working people. Or, to be honest, much like Eisenhower did, at a much higher rate. Because again, from those who much is given, much is expected. Because understand, things aren't working. Wages have been stagnant and declining for 40, 50 years because we've been trying this experiment. Got to give the rich people all the money. We've got to maximize shareholder wealth. We've done that. We got massively wealthy shareholders. In fact, so many wealthy people that they're taking Supreme Court justices on vacation, paying for their great-grandnephew or whatever to go to school. All kinds of stuff, buying RVs and all the other crazy stuff that's gone on. $1 million fishing trip to Alaska. It's crazy, but it's the stuff that happens. Maybe if we tax them in a way that you go, that's a bit too much money. Maybe things are a little better. Maybe if we were to bring society back together in that kind of, we're in the same arena, not in the same seats, but at least in the same ballpark. Like we had, from the end of World War II up until, the mid to late 70s, up until the Reagan era really kicked off and took off. It's a start. and something we should be pushing and striving for. So when I see the headline, Amazon's cutting prices, how wonderful. I think nonsense. It's ridiculous that they were allowed to raise them through the roof to begin with, along with all the other ones that have gouged our eyes out. Maybe we start holding them accountable, and maybe we have a political system that wants to do that. And maybe, here's a better idea, we have a voting populace who demands it. So when you go to the polls, maybe say, you know what? I want someone held accountable. I want someone to have to pay. Seems simple to me. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, always want to hear it. Also, make sure, I hope everyone had a good, happy Father's Day. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ney is going to be here, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to share some top thoughts of the day. Back after this.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR, Rapids' home of Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Showers and storms this evening, mostly cloudy overnight. Lows, low 70s. Warmer and more humid tomorrow. Highs, upper 80s and breezy. Afternoon and evening, storms return. Heavy rain, large hail, isolated tornadoes, and gusty winds all possible. It's 67 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
This broad reaching, well, we can't help people because we can't control how they spend the money, somehow magically doesn't apply to billionaires, doesn't apply to corporations who dodge their taxes every year. The only people who are subject to the conservative morality police are poor people. How dare you?
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I am going to fill up your summer reading list really quickly. On Monday, we talked about the wolves of K Street. You know, all of the moneyed interests that have gone into taking over our democracy and our government. You know, the best democracy money can buy. One end of the political spectrum, the other, labor history. One of the things that I'm extremely passionate about. Anyone who listens to the program has heard our labor history in two. Know it's something that we push. But I came across this book, Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States. And I said, this is somebody we got to come and talk to. That's why I've asked Jay Albert Mann to come talk with us. She's a disability activist and award-winning author for young people. And Shift Happens, well, it just happens to be for young people. And look, me too. Jay Albert, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So let's start with this. Shift Happens. Great title. What made you come up with it?
Well, when you're writing for young people, you really want to capture them. And of course, you know, being a little bit of fun, that's always going to capture people's attention.
Now, this is the history of labor in this country from, well, Christopher Columbus until just the other day, isn't it?
Yes. So, right. So I start with Christopher Columbus when he hits the shores of the Bahamas. And I take us all the way up through the stand-up campaign of the United Auto Workers in 2023. So it's a pretty comprehensive history. The one thing I really, well, two things I was doing was I was giving American history in context, and I did it through the point of view of working people. So how working people have lived in this country since before it was this country.
What made you write this? I mean, you know, look, I'm a labor guy. It's my passion. It's something that I've tried to help promote. What made you you jump into the middle of this?
I mean, first, it was something that I would like to have read myself, and I was kind of out there looking for. I'm an armchair labor historian, and I was always looking for kind of the base level. So if people were like, hey, what is the history of the working class? That and I really wanted it in, you know, contextualized inside of history. I didn't want it in these like spots of just hears these big labor moments in isolation away from the actual history that people are living every single day. So that's, I think, the first reason I wrote it. And the second is I write historical fiction. And although my books are about different events, the Revolutionary War, eugenics, women's healthcare, they all have a similar theme of equity. And of course, equity is just something that's really important to me. And it, you know, the inequity that's going on in our country is so upsetting. And so it was the second reason I really wanted young people and anyone, any working person who's interested in their own history should read this book. It's a pretty fantastic history.
No, for me, everything comes from the labor that you endeavor in. We work so that we're able to live, and the history of that work, I think, is really important, especially the abuses of the past, so that maybe we learn from the past and maybe don't have to repeat it in the future.
Absolutely, and in the book, I do mention that. Yes, we hear that saying a lot. If you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. But I say in the book that oftentimes the people in power absolutely know history, and they're repeating it absolutely on purpose. And so as working class people, we have to know our own history so we can stop that, you know.
No, you're spot on. And, you know, they use it as a playbook. We should be using it as something to maybe not do again. And what I love about this, and look, you know, it's become my favorite bathroom book, and I know it shouldn't be, but it's short chapters, real quick reads, and right to the point. Not a lot of extra verbiage, not a lot of flowery filler language. It's straight to the point, and that's what I like about it, that direct, right to the point, quick, get me in, get me out, get me what I need to know.
And I would say that, you know, I write for young people, and that's how young people would like it. But it's also how I like things, too, especially when I'm taking on a subject that I'm not wholly familiar with. You know, you want an overview. And then later, you know, I have a hefty bibliography of all the different sources that I've pulled from. Many of them scholars, labor scholars, but also many of them fantastic journalists doing great work. And you could use that bibliography not only to learn about the past, but also to follow, you know, as we head into the future. Those journalists are out there working, and a lot of them are working for, you know, they're not working for the Post or the New York Times. They're working for like the Real News and other news sources that working people should also know about.
Yeah, I do plan on stealing some of your bibliography, just so you know, because, you know, look, we do labor history in too, and it's one of the things, you know, it's well researched, it's well noted, it's something that it's going to give me some direction, and I'm going to throw that out as a compliment. I hope you take it that way.
Oh, absolutely, Rick. Absolutely. I mean, it would be thrilling to be stolen from. I would be thrilled. For me, you know, of course, like I wrote this book, I find it extremely important that working people know our history. I think it's the only way that we're going to change things. We're the most powerful group on the face of the earth, and we've been being pulled apart through what I call the pyramid of oppression in the book, where we're stamped as women, black folks, white folks, disabled folks, you know, we're pulled apart and then we're stacked on top of each other, and we're made to kind of do a lot of infighting within us, within ourselves. And I would love to point that out, because it's really promoted by the commercial press, this, you know, identity, and, you know, and the only thing that's going to bring us together is the fact that we are all the same. All work for a living.
No, you're spot on. And, you know, one of the things we say here on the program all the time is the only way I see us reuniting this country is if we reunionize, because it is the one thing, black, white, Hispanic, however they slice and dice us, you know, white collar, blue collar, pink collar, ring around the collar, however they slice and dice us up, this is what can bring us back together. So learning this history, learning about those divisions and maybe how we bridge them, a pathway forward, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And just how, you know, to understand the cycle that they've put us in, and the control that they have over us through, you know, the commercial you know, the commercial press. I mean, I think it's something like six companies now or eight companies own 90% of the media. That's a lot of control.
Yep.
And to break out of that, you know, we have to understand the words they use and, you know, the verbiage and, you know, kind of what they've done to us so that they can keep controlling.
Well, I mean, the reality is, you know, some of the things we've been talking about here, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, I look at Iowa, I look at a lot of red states right now, they're undoing child labor protections. They're going after child labor laws because we want those kids back in the workplace, get those kids back in the mines and the mills and the meat packing plants because they got small hands. They can do intricate work. And again, you know,
and they're cheap.
Of course, they're cheap and exploitable, and they're not going to ask too many questions. And this is where learning our history, maybe we go, let's not do that because it's bad for children.
Absolutely. And then they sell it by saying, I mean, right now unemployment is really low. So, of course, like, you know, we're going to have a little more power as working people. And so how to diffuse that power is to bring in more workers. And at this, you know, there's two ways to do that. Send labor abroad someplace else. Or start, you know, bringing in kids. So 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds into, you know, longer hours, more dangerous jobs. And then they sell it that they're going to learn, well, they're going to learn what values? They're learning in school. Leave them in school for two more years, yeah. You know. They can do a lot of learning there. And then they can, guess what, be out in the workforce with the rest of us for the rest of their lives. So I really do think leaving them alone for 2 years is not such a big deal. But of course, it is when you have a lot of cheap labor out there to, you know, to take advantage of.
Or 4 years, because you look at some of the stuff in Iowa, they're letting 14-year-olds drive to work. So that's a problem. The book Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States by J. Albert Mann. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick this up. Highly, highly suggested for your summer reading list. Anything in here that, you know, as an amateur historian, as you said, anything that you researched that you went, wow, that's shocking. Anything that jumped out at you, maybe a little teaser in there for a nugget for people to find?
I mean, gosh, I think there's so much shocking things in there that it's like so numerous. But I think the thing that gets me about labor history the most is really just how dangerous it is to work for a living, how dangerous it's been in the past to work for a living. And if we don't keep on it, if we don't, you know, stop the cycle, that it could be that dangerous again. And so I think that's the most shocking thing. In 1904 in New York City alone, 27,000 workers died on the job. So 27,000 workers. And I know that maybe kids or someone sitting at home would say, oh, well, that was 1904. Well, if we don't stop things like what you're talking about with child labor, that number right now is actually increasing. So from 2010 until now, more workers have been dying on the job than previously. So, you know, I find that interesting. We need to come home at night to our families. We need to come home at night.
Ultimately that. And you know, but beyond, you know, just being safe, being rewarded for your work, having dignity in the workplace, having some type of value to yourself, I think all important as well, because I believe there's dignity in work. And it should be respected. And sadly, I think we're in an era right now where that dignity and respect has, well, been abused.
Absolutely. I cleaned bathrooms at McDonald's for 5 years. And, like, I heard some CEO the other day, like, well, how much do they want for cleaning a bathroom? And I just think they should be the highest paid. You know, a clean bathroom is not only healthy, but it's a joy. It doesn't matter what job you do. You're absolutely right, Rick. There is dignity in all jobs, and even calling jobs skilled or unskilled, it takes skill to do every single job.
Anything in here you found humorous? Anything that made you chuckle? Anything that made you go, hey, this is good? I mean, because we can look back at history and point out all the negative stuff. Anything that you said, hey, this is a positive?
I mean, I think that I try to focus on the community more than I do the people. But there's just some characters in this book that you just have to fall in love with. And, you know, people like Eugene V. Debs and, you know, Mother Jones, who, like, is 90 years old and showing up at a strike and being thrown into jail. Like, it's some of the characters in this Big Bill Haywood and even Sean Fain makes an appearance. Like, I think, I don't know about funny, but I do think that these people are heroes and they warm my heart. And so I would say that's very special. Some of the folks I point out in this book.
What are you hoping young people take from this? I think adults should read this as well, because there's a lot of information that most people my age don't even know. Probably don't know 3/4 of what's in this book. So reading a book for a teenager at a teenager level, you know, might be a good read for an afternoon for an adult as well. But what are you hoping young people take from it?
I think civic competence, just how important civic competence is. You know, math skills, science skills, reading comprehension, this is all really important. But so is engaging in our democracy. And it's exciting and it's a responsibility. And I hope that they read it and think, wow, like, I need to get involved. And I think young people today really want to be involved. And so I think that's what I would love, that they read this book and say, yes, I'm going to step in. I'm going to be a citizen of this country.
This is an awesome book, I got to tell you. I love it. I hope people will take a look at it. Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States by J. Albert Mann. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick it up. Powell's Books is a place where you can go, obviously, to get it. But J. Albert Mann, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
Again, the book Shift Happens. And you know what? The challenge is, every union member watching this, you should be buying this for your children. This is how you can pass down that legacy. And, oh, by the way, maybe get one, give it to school, the local library. Maybe we distribute this so that people learn a little about labor's history. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day that 18,000 workers in Chicago's stockyards went out on strike. Work in the stockyards was often brutal and dangerous. Thousands of workers toiled in the yards, many of them immigrants from Eastern Europe. They worked butchering and processing the hogs and cattle raised in the American West into meat for distribution by rail to consumers across the country. The industry gave Chicago the nickname Hog Butcher for the World. In 1904, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union organized a strike. The main demand was increased wages. The meatpacking companies were able to get scabs to cross the picket lines and act as strike breakers. Most were African Americans and European immigrants. Many of these workers had not been organized by the union, which was dominated by the skilled German and Irish packing house workers. Novelist Upton Sinclair visited the stockyards during the strike to research conditions faced by the workers. In his famous novel, The Jungle, Sinclair gave a fictionalized account that captured the devastating impact of the scabs on the strike. He wrote, quote, "Such were the stockyards during the strike, while the unions watched in sullen despair, and the country clamored like a greedy child for its food, and the packers went grimly on their way. Each day they added new workers and could be more stern with the old ones, could put them on piecework and dismiss them if they did not keep pace." It was not until the 1930s when the stockyard unions took seriously the task of organizing across race, ethnic, and skill lines that they finally won a contract and gained the rights of union recognition. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the book Shift Happens, The History of Labor in the United States. Make sure you find this book. Give it to a young person. Maybe read it yourself. I highly suggest on the summer reading list. I'm enjoying it very much. And again, the idea of learning where we've come from, so maybe we don't screw it up in the future. So Politico article caught my attention. It seems Republicans are back on the campaign trail, taking credit for things that they didn't do. The bipartisan infrastructure bill, in which I don't know why they keep calling it bipartisan. There are only 13 Republicans in the House that voted for it when the majority did not. The vast majority of Republicans did not. But that's not stopping some of them from taking credit. And you look at the person who is the representative in Iowa's first congressional district, Marionette Miller Meeks, who her district, huge money going there, something like $298 million already of the $470 million that are going to that district. Out there taking credit for, look how wonderful. You know, I was against all of that other spending, you know, for everyone else. But this, that makes me look good, all in favor of. In fact, my congressman, Scott, pardon me, Perry, there's a boatload of cash coming in to his district as well. Some $124 million already spent. Some $432 million allocated for his district. Again, a guy who was never going to support it. But his district is going to benefit from it. And this is one of those moments where I go, you know, I'll be honest. You know, maybe the Trumpian, very Machiavellian way of doing things is maybe that's what we have to do on a certain level. Now, I understand, you know, look, Biden's all about good governance, all about building the entire country, even people who don't agree with him. And look, Scott, pardon me, Perry, most certainly not one of those people. So again, I think you got to keep pointing out the fact that, you know, people like Nancy Mace, who's getting a boatload of money into her first congressional district in South Carolina, maybe you keep pointing out that you voted against it. And all of the Republicans, except for those 13, who are mostly gone now because they were just wiped out by the Republicans. How could you be a traitor and side with them for the good of the country? How dare you? Quite remarkable. I saw an interesting story over at Bloomberg I wanted to talk a bit about. Evidently, IKEA was having a hard time keeping employees. You know, we've heard for a while that, you know, people who aren't happy in their jobs are leaving, finding other jobs. And I've been saying all along where if you want to maintain a stable workforce, if you want to keep your employees, pay them well, treat them well, give them decent benefits, give them a reason to stay. Well, evidently, the Swedish corporation, IKEA, who was losing a bunch of people, and it was costing like $5,000 per employee to replace them. Evidently, they thought, hey, maybe what we should do, what Rick says, pay them better, treat them better, give them better opportunities, subsidize their child care, give them more flexible work schedules, do some things to make them, oh, I don't know, happier. Because happy employees tend to want to stay. Employees that don't worry about where their kids are going to be at tend to want to stay. People who can put food on the table tend to want to stay. People who have decent health care and decent retirement security, the opportunity that if they work hard, they play by the rules, they get ahead, they tend to stay. I know, it's remarkable. Who would have thought, you know, that it would work? You know, I've been saying this, been saying, hey, you know, maybe try this. Well, the Swedish retailer, IKEA, did. And what they found? People are staying. Who knew? Who knew that people who were paid well, treated well, and valued would actually want to stay? Wow. Quite remarkable. And finally, I got to talk about this because the U.S. Department of Labor is putting out their final rule on raising the minimum salary levels that get you exempt from overtime. On the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's a white collar exemption. And that says, look, you know, if you make a certain amount per week, per year, you're exempt from overtime. So if you work 10 hours or 100 hours, you get paid the same salary. during the Obama years, it hadn't been raised in a while. They raised it from the $23,660. Yeah, $23,660. They wanted to raise it up to $47,000. A little over. There's $47,500, I believe it was. And immediately the lawsuits came fast and furious, stopped it until the Trump administration came in. And they crushed that and said, well, we got to do something because it'll make us look like ogres and it'll make us look bad. So they raised it from $23,660 up to $35,000. And to be honest, that left millions of people without protections and without overtime. And so the Biden came in, the Department of Labor said, hey, we're going to look into this. We're going to make new standards. And they have come up with a new threshold. And as of July 1st of this year, that new threshold will rise from $35,500, some change. I think it's $684 a week, up to $844 a week, or $43,888 a year. In 2025, on July 1st, that number will jump even higher, up to $1,128 a week, or $58,656. For the simplified exemption, for the high earners, for the big wigs, that on July 1st of this year will increase from $107,000 up to a little over, almost $133,000. And then next year on July 1st, up to $151,000. So for the upper folks, that threshold's much higher. But for your local fast food restaurant manager, for your local retail manager, for people who have been given a nice cute little tag, says assistant manager or manager on it, you're now going to get some overtime protection, or you're going to make a decent amount of money. And I've been talking about this since, before the Obama folks came out and said, hey, we should raise this, because we should have been raising this decades ago. In fact, it should have kept up with inflation from the 70s forward. When reality is, in order to get to this threshold, you were making decent money. You were making good money for the time. 23,660, back in the 70s and 80s was a good living. And it had, thanks to Reagan, thanks to the Republicans who have stopped all this, it's stagnated. So now Biden's trying to kick this up. Now, here's the thing. You don't have to pay your workers $1,128 a week. You don't have to pay them the $43,888. You don't have to pay that. But you do have to pay them overtime after 40 hours. So you don't get to cheat working people out of hours of their lives. And this is a good thing. So how do Republicans respond? Well, we know corporate America, a slew of lawsuits. But how do Republicans respond? Well, last week, the Republicans filed a resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act. This could nullify this. Representative Tim Walberg, Republican of Michigan, and 40 other Republicans joined together, co-sponsored the resolution last week on Friday. No Democrats have signed on to it. In the Senate, you got Mike Braun, the Republican from Indiana, leading the way there. Now, is it gonna happen? Probably not, because Biden would have to sign off of it. I doubt he's going to veto something that he's in favor of. But it goes to show the messaging, because this is a messaging vote. This is who's on the side of low wages, who's on the side of corporate America. And I got to tell you, it's pretty remarkable that you've got that many Republicans in this day saying, yeah, I want my name attached to making sure that workers don't get decent wages. Now, like I said, employers don't have to pay those higher limits. They can choose to work people 40 hours, pay them an hourly wage. In fact, you could pay them $7.25 an hour, because that is our minimum wage. But you don't get to work them 100 hours without paying them overtime. And for me, that's the point of all this, and the good point. And again, there's so many things that this administration is moving forward on to make workers' lives better that our mainstream corporate-controlled media, they never follow up on. But this is one of those things. Just one more in a long line of things that I think this administration is doing right. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What do you think? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.